Welcome back to the Move Podcast. If you're watching on YouTube or maybe on Facebook, you can see that we have a slightly different lineup than we always do on the Move. And we're covering a lot more races with that reason. We've got Spencer Martin, who's been joining the show. And of course, Johan will do every show in every language on the planet. You name it, he'll be there. So,
we'll see how many hours in a day we have.
Yeah. But this way we can cover a lot more racing throughout the season. So this has been a lot of fun. And today we're going to be talking E3. First time for me watching what they refer to as the baby Flanders, or the lead up to Flanders, whatever you want to call it. Very exciting race. Before we get into that, we do have Lance here with a message from one of our sponsors.
Today's show brought to you by Ventum as well. Now, gee, this is special. You and me are back riding the same bikes.
I know, man. I'm excited.
I got the man converted.
We spend our
whole lives riding the same bike. What are we? Well, except for a couple of those years, but we don't want to talk about those. But how's it been? How's the jump to Ventum?
I love it. I did a gravel race with my son last weekend on the GS1, and what a great fun ride. I mean, it's just really handles the dirt really well. Super compliant, yet very stiff, like stiff enough to where you feel the bike move when you need it to move.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about both of my NS1 and my GS1. The GS1 is just you want a rocket ship of a gravel bike, don't look any further.
I'm excited to take that NS1 on the cobbles in Flanders, which Johan and I will talk about later.
Well, exactly. We're going to talk about it right now. So we have Ventum is offering a special giveaway. So George, you're taking a crew of folks over to the Tour Flanders. It's going to be you and Liz and Johan. You've got all the special VIP treatment that you guys always get. I don't know anything about that stuff, but you guys are going to be totally taken care of. We got a whole, I guess, from what you told me a minute ago, the damn thing sold out in like half a second. We got a waiting list. But Ventum will be there in full force. They're also giving away a nice little package here. Sign up, go over to wedo.team, click the Flanders giveaway tab. Takes 1 minute. The last day to enter is April the 2nd. Everybody who signs up in the drawing for a Ventum NS1, you're also eligible for prizes from Roca, Element, Fidlock, Manscaped, Montcush, The Feed, and Huckberry. All you got to do is head on over to ventumracing.com/themove. Use the code WEDO, W-E-D-U. Hello, I'm the one who invented the brand. W-E-D-U at ventumracing.com/themove. That gets you 10% off.
All right, very exciting race. We'll jump right to the ending and then kind of work backwards at how it all went down. But it's just amazing that these three riders, Pogacar, Van Aert, and Vanderpool, are just so superior to everyone at the moment. It's just unbelievable. As Johan always says, another level. They're just on another level. And they're very close. They're very close in margin day to day. So let's talk about that dramatic finish where they slugged it out like gentlemen and get into that. Of course, Wout van Aert with the big victory.
Yeah. Well, I think once we passed the last climb, and that was with a little over, the last real climb was the Quaremont cobbled climb, and so those three guys, it was clear that we're going to go to the finish. I couldn't see anything happening on the last difficulty, which was about 15-20 kilometers from the finish, so it was kind of impossible to foresee that one of those three would get away and it would be a sprint, right? So in this case, I think the chances of Pogacar were very slim, and we all know how tight Van Aert and Van Der Poel are in sprints. This time, Wout van Aert won, and I think quite dominantly. And even, I have to say, he was probably the least strong guy of the three. I think Pogacar and Van Der Poel were a little bit stronger than him, but, he won this race second year in a row. Won it last year together with his teammate Laporte. But I think this is something that Van Aert needed. He lost against Van der Poel in the World Championships cyclocross in a sprint. he lost against Van der Poel in San Remo. And you know, there's so much pressure on that guy. It was amazing to see, like, I don't know if you saw the image just after he passed the finish line and he yelled into the camera, and he said, "I don't have to win. I don't, it's like, I don't have to do anything," because, you know, in Belgium, they said, Van Aert has to win. Van Aert has to win. Van Aert has to win. And he said, "I don't have to anything," you know, like this big explosion of joy and a huge relief, I think, for him, especially in terms of the psychological war that's, you know, these guys have been dealing it with for the last 10, 12 years in their careers.
So I never thought about that aspect of it, Johan. Just there's already the comparison of the two constantly, that sort of pressure, but I didn't think about just the Belgian pressure and the media and the people. It just, the weight on his shoulders. It's like, wow.
Well, Johan and I talked about this yesterday in our Outcomes podcast, which no one should listen to because we got it very wrong on this race. But I was asking Johan if it was reversed and Van Aert wins San Remo and Van der Poel gets third, you know, I just think the pressure is not as intense on Van der Poel, maybe because he's Dutch and he doesn't have the Belgian media, but it just felt like a lot. Like you could feel the weight of the world on Van Aert when he was following Pogacar in the Poggio. And I thought it was interesting today. I thought he was racing San Remo not to lose. And then today it felt like he didn't care if he lost the race. He was willing to lose it to win it, if that makes sense. He was the one always following, always moderating the effort. And he knew he needed to win in a sprint. And he took a risk by, you know, not doing anything and just waiting for that sprint. And
I think not doing anything, it's probably also, I think he knows, and he was honest about that, you know, that he was a bit on the limit on both the Quaremont and on the Paterberg. But he said specifically, you know, as soon as I made it over the Quaremont, you know, he kind of kept his pace. He knew he was going to come back anyway. But from then on, it was focus on the sprint. And he said, you know, I've learned my lesson. You know, winning against Van der Poel is you can't make it a short sprint. You have to go quite early. And he went from 250 meters to go. So it was quite early. They almost started equally. I think Van Aert was just a fraction of a second. But, you know, Van der Poel came next to him. And then finally, Van Aert could keep the speed and Van der Poel had to sit up. But yeah, I mean, you know, he lost the Tour of Flanders that way against Van der Poel, and he lost the World Championships cyclocross with a short sprint, and now finally he did a longer sprint, which was in his favor.
Well, it felt like he watched the remember that Giro d'Italia stage where Benjamin Girmay beat Van der Poel with that long sprint. And it was almost same thing from Van der Poel, where it looks like he's going to have it, and then he just blows up and has to sit up. So Van der Poel Van Aert did his homework there for sure.
That's interesting, you guys, because when I was watching, I was like, oh no, did he come around too early? Like he could have sat on that wheel a lot longer. And I was wondering if that's just a gentleman's kind of way of sprinting between those two in particular. I know there were three there, but instead of, you know, coming around at the last second, they just don't like to win that way. Did you see that at all?
Well, I think it's more a result of, you know, Van Aert having done his homework and studied, and so he lost two times against Van der Poel with a short sprint. He also saw that, as you said, you know, I didn't think about the Girmay stage, but when Kasper Asgreen won against Van der Poel in Tour of Flanders, it was the same thing. It was a longer sprint. And, you know, they were head to head, and all of a sudden Mathieu van der Poel had to kind of sit up. So I think it says a lot also about the qualities of Van Aert as a champion. You know, he was definitely not the strongest one of the three, but he won. And, you know, that's also what makes a great bike rider. I mean, it's not always the strongest guy. I mean, today I think Pogacar was the strongest, but for him it was going to be difficult to win once he was you know, away with those two other guys.
I don't know if you caught the post-race interview with Van Aert, but the host, I don't know who it was, pointed out that, said, we have a full-size couch for you this week. he says, yeah, that was awkward.
Yeah. I know. Yeah.
And there was another funny moment with Van Aert too, when he said something like, you know, they're saying this is the perfect podium because of the three stars. And he goes, yeah, because I'm in the middle.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love it. Okay. Let's take a step back and kind of go through what else went down and other things you guys observed. Before we do that, I just want to take a second here and tell you about some big news coming from our friends at Manscaped. Big news on two fronts. They have the brand new Weed Whacker 2.0. All right. That's all your below the waist needs. Above the waist, they have just come out with this, the Beard Hedger Pro Kit. All right. So if you want to take care of that beard, leave it looking nice. I'll be able to tell you a lot more about it on a future show. I believe it's showing up at my house today. And as you can see, if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, not rocking the beard right now, but the first few seasons of the move, I did. So now having a product like this, the Beard Hedger Pro, really, really looking forward to it. Might bring it back. Might just bring it back here. And that also in that kit includes a beard shampoo and conditioner, beard oil, and beard balm to take care of moisturizing. So if you want to get this as a gift for yourself or a friend, 20% off and free shipping when you use our code. Again, 20% off. Use the code THEMOVE at manscaped.com. One more time, 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Use our code THEMOVE. All right, let's jump back in. I know we'd like to start out talking about, you know, the big win, but let's go back a little bit and break down some other things that went down that you guys thought were really important, especially leading up to Flanders. What were some of your observations?
Well, you know, as we said in our Outcomes podcast, the three guys who were the favorites, there were the three of them were 500-1, right, Spencer?
Yep, all three same odds.
Yeah. So, you know, I definitely would have expected that it was a bit closer at the end of the last difficulty, and that the 40 kilometers left would, you know, give the possibility for other riders to come back and then play tactically. But, you know, these guys are just so strong and so much better than the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth. That gap that they are getting, basically, and it was not so much about with working together, because they weren't really working together. They were, you know, Pogacar was trying to drop them, Van der Poel was on the wheel, and Van Aert was almost getting dropped. So even at that pace, they are taking 45 seconds to a minute on the next ones. Which, you know, then afterwards, once the three of them were together, they said, okay, you know, let's just go for it, because the three of them thought that they could win, or at least I think Van der Poel and Van Aert thought that they were going to win, and rightfully so. So, but we saw that, you know, with 75K to go, with the Tyenburg, which was like the first big selection, we saw Van der Poel putting in a huge effort. And there we saw that Van Aert could follow. He was a little bit behind. He could bridge up quite easily, and the two of them went away. And Pogacar was a little bit delayed. He was a little bit in the back, but could make it back. And from there on, basically, it was these three guys, and basically everybody else was waiting to see what was going to happen. Some other guys could anticipate and get away, and everybody else was just, okay, whatever they do, we're just going to try to stay as close as possible to them. That's going to be our race. And that's what we saw.
And so, yeah, from like 80K to go to 30K to go is all these clusters of famous Flanders climbs. It became immediately apparent. I started to worry about our picks, Johan, when Van der Poel went that hard on the Tyenburg. I was thinking, I don't know, like, if anyone can hang with this guy. Van Aert was right on his wheel, looked really good. Did you, I started to think, oh, well, they're going to have these groups of teammates. I thought it was like Vanderpool had a teammate up the road on the Tyenberg and he kind of blew by him at the top.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, should he have slowed down? And it ended up not mattering because it was just the three guys. But it was like, does he know that that's his teammate? What's he doing right there? But
yeah,
it was just.
Well, I think he probably would have wanted that. It was Dries de Bont who went away like in between two little climbs and then went to the breakaway, which was still ahead, but he would, you know, probably have wanted him to be 10-15 seconds further ahead.
Yeah.
But, you know, that can be the plan, but then if the legs don't work, then, you know, then you have one guy, a teammate who's just not strong enough to get that extra 10-15 seconds. And then you have Van der Poel who's too strong and they come closer together, not at the right moment. So, but I think personally what I've seen is that and it's like we said yesterday also, Spencer, you know, if you really want to break the strength of Jumbo-Visma in numbers, the big guys have to go early. And that's what Van der Poel did. You know, he went early and then on top of that, Jumbo-Visma had the bad luck that Van Baarle was involved in a crash. But you know what? Van Baarle was not up front anyway. So it was basically going to be a man against man, which in the case of Van der Poel and Pogacar works out the best, because imagine that Van Aert has two or three teammates left, then they're prisoners, you know, and then the teammate of Van Aert is going to win.
Yeah.
Why don't you, for those three guys that are on the podium, can you kind of compare their team support today? Obviously Jumbo being the better of the three.
Yeah. Well, I mean, today, the way it worked out, it was, you know, Van Aert had one teammate, which was Nathan van Hooijdonk, who, you know, anticipated after the time back, I think. Van der Poel had Søren Krag Andersen, who we all knew that he was in great shape since Milan San Remo. He was with Van Hooijdonk. And Pogacar had nobody. But he had a Slovenian, not a teammate, but it was Matej Mohoric who was up front. But in the end, it didn't really matter, you know, because these guys, once we got the six guys went to the Tyenberg and there it was, you know, I've actually never seen something like this, you know, like a small group going to the Tyenberg, which is normally the last climb in the Tour of Flanders. But even there, you had a battle for position between these three first ones. You had Pogacar and Van der Poel and Van Aert, and they were battling for position on who was going to be the first guy to take the Tyenberg. And it turned out to be Pogacar finally who went first and basically did a repeat of what he did last year in the Tour of Flanders. You know, and that's what always amazes me so much, you know, like, with these guys, they're so good that they basically think, okay, I did this last year, so I'm going to do this again. I mean, and normally in cycling, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to find the ideal circumstances to do a repeat of what you've done. But these guys, it's like, they're so strong that they just do it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I say, I think we're going to see a repeat again next Sunday. I mean, not this Sunday, coming Sunday in Flanders.
Well, JB, to your question, I was wondering the same thing during the race, like, oh, Pogacar is isolated here. Vanderpool has a teammate. Van Aert has a teammate. This could be really tough for him. And then over the course of one climb, he just neutralized the whole advantage and made it a man-on-man-on-man race. Johan, I'm a little curious on your thoughts on, you know, he was really putting pressure on, I assume, Vanderpool, but you could see it on Van Aert. Van Aert was tailing off a little bit. I started live betting Van Aert when I saw him getting distance, because I was thinking, well, his odds are going to, you know, the market's going to move against him. You're going to get a good price on him. But also I was thinking, well, what's Pogacar's plan here? So let's say he slams it up and over these climbs, he has to do it. You know, he has to try something. He clearly can't get rid of Vanderpool. What if they go over one of those climbs with like a 6 second gap on Van Aert? Like, what would they have done? Would he really have worked with Vanderpool to pull him to the line, or would it all have come back together anyway? Like, was Van Aert not in as big of trouble as it looked like?
Well, if they would have gotten like a 6 to 10 second gap, I think the guy who would have gone full gas would have been Van der Poel, together with Pogacar. And Pogacar, would be, I mean, it would be in his interest to work also. Yes and no, because he could have potentially a better chance if Van der Poel and Van Aert are together.
So they're looking at each other when he's attacking later. Yeah, like he almost needed Van Aert to be there.
But there was no terrain left. You know, it's not like Pogacar was going to drop Van der Poel and Van Aert on the last climb on the Tegenberg, which is, you know, normal pavement and not very steep. So, you know, I mean, I think it was telling to you know, we could see the difference in strength, but doesn't mean that Van Aert won't be stronger next Sunday. You know, I mean, in a week, times a lot could change. Now, Van Aert does, if I'm correctly, he does race Gent-Wevelgem this Sunday. Van der Poel and Pogacar are not racing, so it's just a question of how are they going to bridge the gap now towards the next weekend. But those are the three guys we're going to see again. And at the end, you know, it doesn't really matter so much how strong their team is in terms of tactics in the final, because they go so fast that none of their teammates can be there. The only way that they can have a teammate in the final is if they have a teammate up front. Other than that, you know, and that's in Pogacar's case, for example, it's great to know, because as long as he has teammates around him to bring him in good position, then he's fine. Because I mean, today, specifically today on the Quaremont, on the old Quaremont, I mean, that's a long climb. I mean, for Flanders, right? I mean, he started going as soon as he hit the first cobblestone, he started going. And you know, the first part is steep, and then you get to the church, and then it's like another kilometer falls flat. You know, it's quite long. This guy just is fearless. You know, he just goes, and it was only Mathieu van der Poel who could follow, like last year, same thing.
It's a little crazy. I mean, it wasn't even really a good course for him. I mean, Flanders is a much better race for him than this. This really wasn't hard enough. As we saw, he couldn't get rid of anyone. Have you, in both you and JB, have you guys ever seen this before, where like a Tour de France contender while still contending for the Tour de France is mixing it up with elite cobbled classic riders? I don't know if I've ever seen this since I've been watching cycling.
There is one rider in history who has won this race and afterwards in the same year the Tour de France.
I heard it on television today, so let's let Spencer guess.
It's it's got to be. I guess Eddie Merckx would be my guess.
Eddie Merckx never won this race.
Wow! So
what a disappointment his career was.
Would it be like Bernardino or something? That I can't believe Eddie Merckx won this race. I'm shocked.
More recent
than Bernardino. So would it be? Is it? Oh wait, what? Who would this be? More recent than, you know, is it Greg LeMond?
Okay, 3, 2, 1, your time is up. It's Geraint Thomas.
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah, because he won this in 2015.
Geraint. Yeah. Well, I mean, he won this race and the Tour, not in the same year.
Yeah, but not in the same year.
Yeah.
And he was a fundamentally kind of an interesting career that maybe I haven't fully digested, but yeah, he was a classics rider, and then he just transitioned into a Tour de France rider pretty quickly, which I forget about.
Yeah.
Well, let's dig deeper on what Spencer has brought up here, because, you know, Pogacar has to face these two guys every one of these classics. And, you know, the goal should be July, right?
It's not. You know, that's the thing, JB. Pogacar's goal is, I mean, of course, he wants to win the Tour, but his big goal is to win the Tour of Flanders.
Wow.
He said already in an interview in Belgium that, you know, he would prefer to win the Tour of Flanders than the Tour de France this year, which is, you know.
That's just so different from the mindset we have all always had.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, that's the big change, you know, that's the big change. And the thing is, he can do both. That's amazing. Like Pogacar is here rivaling with these two superstars, the strongest guys in the world, Van der Poel and Van Aert, since forever. He comes into this, you know, without doing any of those preparation races. He comes into this, he rival, he's the strongest one. But then he come July and he's the big favorite for the tour. And there, of course, Wout van Aert and Van der Poel, they have other functions, but they would never be able to rival with Pogacar in a Grand Tour. That's what makes him so special. That's, I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. He can do what they do best. They can't even come close to doing what he does best. Johan, coming out of this race, do you think he should feel confident about Flanders? Like where do you think this performance should put him?
I think he does feel super confident. Last year also was the first time he was trying out those races. So he did do the E3 and was up there in the second or the third group. But this year, I mean, obviously now he understands the racing. It's amazing to see because, you know, after only 2 years of racing these races, it's impossible to know off by heart all these climbs and the way you go, especially the way you go to these climbs. Yes, he did recon, but it's not the same. You know, doing one or two recons, I mean, you can know the course, but if you don't know how to race it, and even there, you know, Pogacar makes no mistakes. You know, he's up there and he's strong. And, you know, the only time he was not there was on the Tijenberg, when Van der Poel went. But on the other climbs, he was the guy, you know, forcing the race. So I think he's super confident for next week. And again, it's one of those riders that it doesn't really matter. I mean, he's the favorite for everybody, including for Van der Poel and Van Aert. Pogacar will be the favorite. And the guy just doesn't care. He just goes whenever he needs to go on the front and just pushes. And I mean, I think it's unique, you know, to see a guy who is so good in stage races, so good in long climbs, to have that kind of power to rival with these watts, whatever you call them, animals, you know, that's quite something.
If you were his director for this race, would you have tweaked his strategy at all? Like, do you think he just rode the perfect race and didn't work out? Or do you think there's anything he could have done today to try to get one over on those two guys?
I think personally that, you know, for Pogacar or for the team UAE, it's not that important if he wins this race or not today. You know, it's all in function of coming Sunday, you know. And there, I think it's easier. I mean, easier. It should be in theory more favorable for him to, you know, 260 kilometers or 267 kilometers. I don't know exactly. So 60 kilometers longer than today. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the Quaremont and the Pottersberg a lot closer to the finish. I would feel pretty good about my chances as long as they can keep him safe and in good position and there's no bad luck involved. He's going to be there.
Wow. Who was the biggest loser today, team-wise? We're used to seeing Soudal Quickstep and all over things in the spring. Mm-hmm. That's the normal.
Well, you know, already last year we saw that was not the case. You know, I mean, in the spring campaign, they were still called, what they called last year, the Koenig Quickstep, no? I mean, I'm still not used to these name changes. Let's just call them Quickstep, yeah? Quickstep. Yep. Or the Wolfpack, you know. you know, the Wolfpack, I think the Wolfpack is transforming into a Wolfpack around Remco for those kind of races. And then in the classics today, they were nowhere. They were nowhere in the spring, in the opening weekend in Belgium. So at some point, you know, we saw Asgreen there, we saw Lampard there, and we saw Ballerini, but they could never really put their stamp on the race. And then you know, the one that normally should be there or is supposed to be their leader for these races now is Alaphilippe. I mean, I didn't see nothing of him. I don't know if he had an accident or flat or something, or but that, I mean, it is concerning to see that, you know, that they are today, their first rider is around 20th position or something, or I mean, of course, if you don't make the first split, then it doesn't really matter anymore. But it's telling that this is a team that's transforming. And, you know, I mean, obviously Remco is doing great with the team around him. And I think that logically they will focus more and more on building that team stronger and stronger. And they'll have to forget a little bit about because it's also not like if the team of Patrick Lefebvre would do one big transfer for the classics, it's not like they're all of a sudden going to change. I think they lost their strength in depth of the team, which was always their strong point. And now that's, and other teams are stronger.
Yeah. They've been losing talent and then also not replacing it. It's like not a good place to be. I just wonder, so you look at this chase group, pretty interesting. They were probably never going to catch. The first three were rotating strong enough that it wasn't really a question of if they're going to get caught. But Mateo Jorgensen, American, finishes fourth. Great ride, kind of ripped off a strong chase group. His teammate, Even Garcia Cortina, gets fifth. Stefan Kung sixth. Matty Mudrich seventh. Valentin Mandwas eighth. Soren Krau Anderson ninth. Like, are those riders like in the past that would have been on Quickstep? It just doesn't feel like they're recruiting new classics talent and they're just letting their core age out.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, listen, there's obviously a budget issue. You know, they have a good budget, Quickstep, but they don't have the biggest budget. And so, you know, Jumbo has a good budget. Obviously Craig Anderson didn't change teams to Alpecin for free. You know, they also paid him a lot of money, and you have to make choices. So it's always, it becomes a problem when you have a big star who you have to, you know, even in the case of Patrick Lefebvre, even if Remco Evenepoel has a long-term contract, he still needs to fight to keep him, because there's candidates trying to come with huge offers to say, hey, you know, we'll pay you so much for so many years. And then even if there's a contract in place, you kind of have to, you know, obviously not match it, because that's why the guy signed already a multi-year contract, but you have to keep them happy. You know, let's say Remco Evenepoel, whatever. I mean, I don't know, but let's say his contract is 2 million, right? And all of a sudden Ineos comes and they say, well, you know, we want Remco. We're going to pay him 5 million for 5 years. I mean, that's like huge. So, as a team manager, you have to make a decision and say, okay, Remco can't go anywhere because he has a signed contract, but I want him to be happy, or at least I want him to see that I'm making an effort. So then maybe you have to pay him 3, you know, not 5, but 3, even if he already has signed for 2 million. So obviously that's going to impact Patrick Lefebvre on the other side of the other team to be able to recruit, if you have a limited budget. So, you know, these are things that we have to keep in mind, that it's not always so easy. It's easy to say, oh, you know, they should get this guy. They should get this guy. At the end, it's a market, and guys like Søren Krag Andersen or Van Baarle or Thijs Benoot, I mean, they're in demand. And these guys obviously are going to go also where they feel good on the sports side, but also where the money's right. And I think in that case that Patrick Lefebvre has a disadvantage. And it's always the same. If you have a big superstar who eats up a big chunk of your budget, then you're limited to build a strong team around them.
Did you struggle with that at Postal with your Grand Tour team and then the Classics team around George?
Well, I mean, we did because, you know, we were, especially because our main focus was the tour always. And so we tried to recruit as strong possible a team for that. And then, you know, hopefully some of those guys could also be good in the classics, but, and it was still possible then, but now I feel like it's getting so specific, you know, Grand Tour teams and Classics teams, it's like two different teams. And so you have to get separate budgets for both of those teams. And back in the days, it was different. You could kind of, there was some riders who, when George was the leader for the Classics, but he was also, you know, one of the fixed guys. I mean, one of the most reliable guys for the Tour. And nowadays, that's not the case. I mean, if you see the team around Remco Evenepoel right now in Tour of Catalonia, I mean, none of those guys would race these kind of races that we're commenting today.
And what's going on with Casper Askren? Like, he won this race in 2021 and then won Flanders. I thought was kind of like the next coming star, maybe behind Van Aert and Vanderpool. And then today he finishes, you know, 7.5 minutes back. Like, is there injuries going on there, or is it just kind of his career stagnated a little bit?
I mean, I don't know exactly what's going on with him. I mean, for me, he's still a very strong rider. Last year he had a lot of problems with injuries, and, you know, he had that bad crash. If I'm not mistaken, if it was in Romandy or the Tour of Switzerland, I don't remember. But then, you know, he struggled in the spring, and he struggled in you know, later on in the season, and obviously he has not come back to his level he was 2 years ago. And, you know, nowadays everything evolves so quickly. Like, if you're 1 year on a lower level, it's like, okay, there's three or four new guys already here. They took your place, and you're done.
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, these guys fighting for contracts, fighting to keep their jobs. They go from being, you know, the young star to the old guy, like, overnight.
Yeah.
It's, which is I was thinking about it just a minute ago, like, more reason to go get the money when you can, when you're young and strong, because these careers are likely ending earlier too.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a lot of life left after bike racing.
We're seeing this more and more, you know, and I think that's also one of the things that a guy like Pogacar, you know, it's not a bad idea. You know, if he really wants to win those races, I mean, the sooner he wins Flanders, the better, because, I mean, listen, you know, he won the Tour in 2020, he won it in 2021. And now we'll see. I mean, if he still wins another Tour, right? I mean, I think it's possible, definitely possible, because he's on a great level, but nothing is guaranteed. You know, I mean, how many big stars have we seen who won a big race and say, oh, it's going to be the first of many? And
Bernal comes to mind.
Bernal. I mean, yeah. Jan Ulrich, for example. I mean, and then we were not talking about really young talent coming, but he won the first Tour at a very young age, and he said, oh, you know, I'm going to win four or five. He won one, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, in top level sports, you really have to, you know, get the benefits when they're there, because nothing's tomorrow's never guaranteed. Right.
Right. Not only the age thing, just the staying healthy, you know,
yeah.
Accidents, no injuries. It's very risky. Yeah. Go get it while you can. Do either of you have a little bit of this is very indulgent for our American audience. Do you have a crystal ball of what the future holds for Matteo Jorgensen, who looked very good today, just off, you know, just behind those top three guys, you know?
Spencer, you want to go first?
Yeah, I was blown away by this. I mean, obviously, like, fourth, that's like internationally probably not moving the needle, but if you really kind of break down that ride that he was able to rip away from a really strong chase group, you know, imagine things really fall apart in that front group. You know, he could have played a role in a podium place. Mm-hmm. And then this is on top of winning, it's also not a major race, but Tour of Oman, he won the GC. It's like, this guy can do anything. Like, I'm kind of blown away with just the width of races that he can show up to and just get results at. And I think a big knock I have on Americans a lot of times is they can be, you know, I don't want to be like disrespectful, but like fragile characters a little bit. Like, if something goes wrong, I feel like American riders can really tailspin, or it's just, oh, they're not always just game for all types of conditions. And Jorgensen just shows up to a Spanish team. Like, I assume he's speaking Spanish inside that team. And
yeah,
he seems to be able to thrive in any type of environment. It's really impressive.
to come back on your thought there about Americans, you know, not being able to deal when things.
Oh, this is going to get good. Everybody pull up some popcorn here. Here we go.
I think Jorgensen is amazingly mature for his age, you know, compared to some really big American talents that I personally had on the team weirdos. Real weirdos. Like, you know, if I think back now, I said this guy and this guy. These guys were unbelievably weirdos, you know. It's like I think that has changed a lot also. I mean, Matteo Jorgensen is you know, right now he's becoming a really confirmed value in pro cycling, and he's gonna be one of the best riders in Movistar. For sure.
He might be there is outside of Enric Mas. Is he their best rider? Is he their second best rider now? I think so too.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Because, you know, he's good in stage races. He can climb. He can time trial decently. And now being able to do these races. I listened to his interview afterwards. This guy knows what he wants. You know, he says he wants to, you know, check out how far he can go in these kind of races. You know, it's not just that he was in that group behind those three guys. He had already been up front before. You know, he was trying to anticipate and was on his own. You know, and if you see these kind of efforts you're doing, and then to being able to recover from that and still stay with some of the good guys and be able to ride away in the end, that takes a lot of quality. I mean, I'm really, really impressed with him today. The future's looking bright for him.
And he was racing for the win. I mean, he probably went off the front knowing I cannot hang with Vanderpoel, Van Aert, Pogacar on these climbs. I have to get a buffer.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's telling me like he immediately kind of understands where he stands and what he has to do to win. I don't want to be hyperbolic, but I could see him winning a race like Tour Flanders at some point in his career.
Well, that's still another game, but
he's probably the best as far as Americans go. He's probably the most likely candidate to win a major classic.
Yeah. I mean, for the moment, for sure. I mean, we had Nielsen Paulus winning San Sebastian a couple of years
ago. That's true. Yeah. But, maybe Cobbled Classic. Nielsen Paulus, another rider.
It's not the same kind
of stuff, but he's riding well too now.
This guy can win San Sebastian too.
Yes. I almost worry that he's so versatile. Does it like, what does he focus on? Is it too many like rotating plates? Like, is he just going to be able to like dial in on one thing, or maybe it doesn't matter? Maybe he can just race all types of races all the time.
You know, things have changed so much, Spencer. You know, if you see Pogacar, you know, he's there. And I think we're going to see this more and more. The guys don't race. They don't race a lot. So and then that brings me to the next point, you know, whether for Pogacar is too early or not, you know. But anyway, to come back on Jorgensen, I mean, I really like the way what I'm seeing. I mean, already last year in Paris-Nice, he showed some really good things. This year starts off with, you know, a win in Oman. Did a really good Paris-Nice also, like rode really well in Paris-Nice, just behind the, you know, the first three big guys, and now to being able to be there in these kind of races, I think we're going to see that more and more. You know, guys who are, I mean, nowadays it's unbelievable to see a guy like Pogacar, a guy like Jorgensen, being up there in these kind of races where before you were supposed to have done it four or five times, you needed the experience. You know, to know the course, to know when to go fast, to know when to rest in between the climbs. These guys just go. Whenever it's uphill and hard and cobbled, they go.
And, remember when they used to say you had to be heavy to ride on the cobblestones? This is like just 5 years ago. And it's like, oh, no, actually, if you're fast, you're probably fast on any type of surface.
Right. You know, that's an interesting point with the changes in technology. And in tire choice, maybe the smaller guys are floating over it a little more than they used to.
I mean, you know, I mean, we all know that the tire pressure they're riding with the bigger tires is a lot less. I don't know if that has an impact on lighter guys compared to heavier guys. I mean, for Paris-Roubaix, I would say a light guy is never going to be able to make it, because there you have to have the proper weight on the bike to have the grip. But you know, for these kind of races, I mean, Flanders is a combination of, you know, cobbles, but the hardest part of Flanders is the climbing. You know, a guy like Philippe Pogana, for example, decides not to do Flanders because he thinks it's too hard for him in terms of climbing. You know, it's all short climbs, but you know, the consecutive climbing of short climbs, it makes it really hard too. So, I mean, who would have thought, you know, a guy like who's considered the specialist in big stage races like Pogacar will be the big favorite in Tour of Flanders. I mean, if you asked me that question 5 years ago, I said, no way. Hmm.
Do you think Pogacar can't win Roubaix because he's too light?
I have to pay attention to what I say, because
listen, you never rule that guy out.
No, if you look at the cobbled stage in the Tour de France last year, he was flying. He was the best of the whole bunch, basically. But I think a guy like Pogacar would normally he would not do Paris-Roubaix, because that's really, really taking too much risk in terms of crashes that can really, you know, have a big impact and have serious injury. Because, you know, it's flat and you go so much faster. And when you crash on those cobblestones, the injuries could be a lot worse than in Flanders. Not that Flanders is not dangerous, but in Flanders, it's more, you know, you get into a crash because there's like too much traffic and you have to kind of, you know,
it's not the same. And JV, it's funny you mentioned that. Someone floated that theory like to me last night, and there was another person there, and they were a pro cyclist, and they shot it down. I think you're on to something, though. I do wonder if like the bigger tires and the new technology is helping riders kind of float over the cobblestones more. It's not as much of like a blunt force interaction with your wheels and the cobblestones.
Yeah, I just think about those high pressure 23s.
Yeah, like 110 PSI.
Right. It's like rock on rock. You know?
But you would never do that for Flanders anyway, even before you were not riding 23s, you're riding 25s with less pressure, but of course not the same low pressure as Paris-Roubaix. But I think you may have a point. You know, I mean, obviously technology evolves, and it's proven now that riding 28s or 30 millimeter tires, or even 32 sometimes, they are as efficient and a lot more comfortable.
Well, let me take this opportunity to mention this about Flanders again. Johan will be there with George and some of our listeners, fans who are doing a VIP experience. That's going to be very cool. Do you know where you're going to be on the course?
Well, we're going to be at the start, at the finish, and then we're going to go to five or six different viewing points. So it's up to us to decide. But it's going to be amazing. It's going to be an amazing, amazing day.
And you can go to wedo.team and sign up for a Flanders giveaway. I don't know why you would not do this. You could win a brand new Ventum, which we are all fans of. Roka is part of the package. Element, Montkush, Manscaped, Fidlock, and more is a big prize package.
So and the Ventum, that's the new model and the complete bike, right, JB?
It's a complete bike. Yeah, I believe it's the new GS1 they just released.
Yeah,
I think Lance just got his new GS1. So it was already an amazing bike, the GS1, the previous version. So I don't know what all the tweaks were, but it must be amazing. So go sign up. Okay, wedo.team, sign up for the Flanders giveaway. We are going to be back on Sunday to talk Catalunya. And if you haven't... And can, oh yeah, yeah, we've got, oh yeah, there's that too. But the, I don't want to do a spoiler if anyone's been banking on Catalunya and want to catch up this weekend, but
yeah,
Roglic,
what a race.
What a show. What a show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. And then, you know, I know you guys do outcomes where you do the deeper dive, but my sense is that we're going to see a similar finish to Flanders. Your thoughts real quick?
Yeah, in my opinion, yeah. I mean, these three guys are the big favorites. Flanders is longer, so there are more tactics involved. And so it's just a matter of how far ahead are some of the teammates of these big favorites. Because I cannot imagine Jumbo-Visma not having a guy up front and Alpecin, De Koenig not having a guy up front. Even UAE, Pogacar should have somebody up front also. But, you know, when in the heat of the action, it's these three and the rest is this.
And I think you kind of said it earlier, you touched on it, because it is longer, that can play as a favor for Pogacar.
Yeah, it's longer, so harder. And you know, the places where he can make the difference, where today he was the strongest on the Quaremont and the Paterberg, are so much closer to the finish. I think, what is it? It's like 12 kilometers from the Paterberg to the finish.
Yeah, and it's condensed. It's, correct me if I'm wrong, the new course, it's Quaremont-Paterberg, they kind of do the loop. And yeah, it's like a brutal little loop. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it could, like, if we had the same conditions, same riders today, I don't think anyone's sticking with Pogacar on those climbs. That's not to say, though, that there is a strong correlation between winning E3 and winning Flanders. And not to say Van Aert doesn't get better over the course of 9 days. 9 days is a long time in terms of fitness.
And even if he doesn't get better, but he, you know, if he gets dropped a little bit and come back, he could still win. He proved it today. But on Sunday, that's going to be more difficult.
Yeah, just because that distance is, it's really like it goes by in a flash of an eye when you crest the Paterberg and then get to the finish line.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll be back this on Sunday, as we just mentioned, for to cover a couple of those races, and then Flanders right around the corner. Thank you very much, Johan and Spencer. If you want to ask questions on the Sunday show, for example, you can shoot those to me at themove@wedo.team. All right. themove@wedo.team. Fire away with your questions. Thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you guys.